preclinical and clinical testing for safety and efficiency. The Dawkon Shield underwent very little preclinical and clinical testing. The Dawkon Shield was withdrawn from the market in 1974 under intense pressure from the FDA. Eventually, all women with Dawkon Shields were strongly encouraged to have them removed. The Copper 7 was voluntarily discontinued by Searle in 1986 without any pressure from the FDA or any other health agency. In fact, the FDA approval of the Copper 7 continues to this day. Withdrawal from the market was due strictly to the cost of defending unwarranted lawsuits and the unavailability of reasonably priced liability insurance.
I want to interrupt you. I have a question.
Certainly, Madam Chair.
The doctor, and I forget his name, I didn't write it down, Mr. Perns.
B-U-R-R-Y.
His video testimony was that the Copper 7 was never independently tested by the FDA. Is that... Does that coincide with your information? Yeah.
The way in which the FDA works is that it does not independently test. It requires the person seeking approval for marketing of a drug or a product to do the testing. And then an application is made to the FDA to review and determine the adequacy of that testing. I believe that what Dr. Burry said was that there should not be, in his opinion, a statute of limitations applied to a product if the allegations were true that inadequate data or wrong data were given to the FDA in order to obtain approval. But if he did say that the FDA didn't test it, he's correct, but that's just because of the procedures they operate under.
So the FDA does not independently test any product which it licenses?
That's correct. They review independently, testing which is done independently. And the testing is done usually independent even of the company trying to seek the approval. In other words, they will go out and find independent testing laboratories or third-party doctors to test, but it's not the FDA who does the testing
itself. So an independent testing laboratory tested the Copper 7 and the Copper T?
It wasn't actually done through a laboratory per se. It was done through a number of different institutions, such as healthcare facilities, who were independent, yes, and then that data submitted to the FDA.
Thanks. Curious about that. Sure. Representative Calhoun.
Did the companies or did the independent testing laboratories then submit their data directly to the FDA for review, or did they do the 7 manufacturers who submitted the information to the FDA?
Data is generally submitted back to the company or someone acting on their behalf for compilation into the format that the FDA requires in what they call a new drug application.
Thank you. Go ahead.
I'll be brief, Madam Chair. Even the methods used to promote the two IUDs were different. The Dawkon Shield was promoted directly to the public. Copper 7 was never advertised directly to the public. It was marketed instead to doctors who were in a far better position to evaluate the product, determine its proper use, and foresee any potential complications. Indeed, the Copper 7 has enjoyed widespread physician acceptance throughout the time it was marketed. The medical literature regarding the Copper 7 and other copper-containing IUDs has generally been favorable. A number of organizations have all endorsed these products, and I'd like to just take a moment, Madam Chair, to read a couple of quotes from organizations. All of these quotes occurred after 1986, after the Copper 7 was removed from the market. Planned Parenthood Federation of America, it is a disastrous situation when women are denied use of the copper IUD because of today's litigious climate and a company's inability to retain insurance coverage. Clearly, the copper IUDs are the best we ever had. The American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology, the American College, not one professor, the American College. We regret the legal climate in the United States that made it necessary for previous manufacturers to withdraw these copper IUD devices. The Center for Disease Control of the U.S. government, many of the adverse effects associated with IUDs in general were strongly related to a single brand of IUD, the Dawkon Shield, no longer marketed. Other IUDs have a very low rate of serious complications. Attached to my testimony, Madam Chair, are letters from the Oregon Medical Association, Associated Oregon Industries, from a doctor
Corwin?
Who is the regional, this district's chairman of the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, who indicates a grave concern with this bill, and from the Society of Physician Assistants, primarily women who spent a good bit of their practice inserting IUDs on behalf of doctors. The Senate Judiciary Committee listened to the arguments and amended Senate Bill 293 to exempt FDA-approved copper IUDs from the bill. We believe that the 5-1 vote in the Senate committee to be both the exercise of good judgment as well as strong support for a doctrine of fairness. We urge this committee to resist the temptation to paint all IUDs with the same brush. The Copper 7 is not the Dalkon shield. My testimony, Madam Chair, goes on to discuss the public policy issues involved and whether or not extending statutes of repose on infinitum is good public policy. We would submit it as not, but in the interest of time, I will not continue on with that line of discussion. We obviously are gravely concerned with the Dash 7 amendment as presented, and Ms. Hewitt will make some remarks along that line.
Thank you. I wonder if there are questions first for Mr. Barra. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to begin by adding another comment to Representative Calhoun's question about the studying and the data that was submitted to the FDA. The data that we've been talking about in the procedure in response to your question, Madam Chair, relates to pre-market testing, which is different from post-market surveillance and testing. Once a product is on the market, there are many tests which are conducted on it independent of either the manufacturer or the FDA. For example, in the IUD arena, there have been something like on the order of 25 public studies, epidemiological studies, which have looked at the relationship, if any, between various kinds of diseases and adverse phenomenon and the IUDs. Some of these studies have been conducted by the CDC, Mr. Barrow's referred to, by independent universities and some by independent researchers. That information is contained in the body of medical literature that is available generally to everyone, including the FDA and the manufacturer of the company. And as a product has a longer experience, that generally becomes the larger and more informative body of evidence about its effects than does the pre-market testing, which is by nature limited in its scope and time. The two reasons why we, on behalf of CIRL, oppose the Dash 7 amendment are that, first of all, from a trial lawyer's standpoint, the amendment is deceptive in what it actually does. That is, the amendment creates a jury question. It means that in order to invoke the protection that this amendment on its face seems to give to a company which has FDA approval is really illusory. It's illusory because in order to reach a determination of whether or not there has been a misrepresentation, the jury is given all of the evidence just as if they were deciding any case, and they decide the issue. It is not a question which can be segregated out and decided by the FDA or by a trial judge in advance of it going to a jury. Any trial lawyer will tell you that this is a very significant distinction between having a determination made before a trial and during a trial. The procedures of a trial, of course, are extremely expensive, extremely variable. As Mr. Barrows pointed out, there have only been a very, very small number of plaintiffs' verdicts in the Copper 7 cases, but there have been an enormous number of cases brought.
Excuse me.
To, yes.
Thank you. Jumping back at that topic, it seems to me that if people came in today and presented information that showing us that the FDA had reviewed the matter and had determined that they had been misled, not even lied to, but misled, that we would have a different story here, that we would have a government agency saying we've looked over the information we were given, and I would always be willing to take another look at a statute of repose anytime people have been sleeping on their rights because someone else misled somebody else. Has there been any determination by a government agency that they've been misled in these proceedings?
No, as a matter of fact, as Mr. Barrows pointed out, the FDA has reviewed not only the Copper 7, but IUDs in general, beginning as early as 1974 and about every 2 or 4 years since then. The FDA has constituted standing committees on drugs and devices which have held months and months, totaling years of hearings and investigation of IUDs. I'm sorry, I cut you off. Yeah.
I wanted to follow up on that.
Yeah.
When we hear stories about individual plaintiffs who have suffered repercussions and they associate it with the use of the Copper 7 or the Dalkon Shield, for that matter, we're trying to focus on individuals, but that doesn't get back to the issue of safety in terms of a drug generally. I assume that safe drugs may still lead to reactions in some individuals, as would some safe devices.
Yes. They do, and the law, in fact, recognizes that by having a provision under the torts law that says that there are some drugs and devices which cannot be made 100% safe, and so they're judged by a standard that's different. Just because somebody has an adverse reaction to any drug or device does not mean the product is defective. The FDA actually has been asked in a formal petition to take action with respect to the Dalkon Shield. So I give you this only by way of illustrating that it has a mechanism, if it wants to or feels it's necessary, to review and to criticize or remove from the market a product. The Women's Health Network, which is a national organization very concerned with IUD safety, brought a petition to the FDA asking them to take action on the Dalkon Shield. So it can be done by plaintiffs groups. It can be done by the FDA itself, and it can certainly be done by Congress, which has also held numerous hearings on the safety and effectiveness of IUDs. So there are mechanisms within the agency that do give the approval, and the short answer is the FDA can take action if it feels it's been misled, and will, and has, but hasn't in the case of the Copper 7.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Yes, I have a question. I'm just not quite clear. How is it that the Dalkon Shield, and this is obviously a background question that pulls us off of the issue a little bit, how is it that the Dalkon Shield could be marketed without FDA approval?
The Dalkon Shield was marketed before there was a legal requirement for FDA approval of the type of device that the Dalkon Shield was. Because the Dalkon Shield had minimal amounts of copper in it, it was considered to be an inert device. And at the time it was put on the market in the early 1970s, there was no method or no mechanism for going to the FDA for approval of that type of a device. So it had to do with what the law was at the time. The Copper 7 not only came later in 1974, but it is considered a drug because it does have copper, which is emitted from the device in levels sufficient to make it a non-inert product.
Madam Chair.
Representative Clark.
You're opposed to the Dash 7 amendments because you think that someone ought not have to disprove that they misrepresented to the FDA some relevant material as part of a larger expense of litigation, in other words. What about a specific prevailing party attorney fee?
It's not practical to have a prevailing party attorney's fee case with a corporation trying to recover attorney's fees against an individual. The individual, for the most part, can't pay the attorney's fees, and the court won't order it, and it's not an effective remedy.
Excuse me.
Representative Mason, and then Representative Mannix.
Yeah, I don't think you understood the thing. Why wouldn't the court order it? You didn't have any choice.
There are very few attorney's fees statutes that don't have some discretionary element in the trial judge. My experience is that if there's any way to avoid it, the court will when it comes to awarding fees to a plaintiff. And I speak not even from the products liability area, but more from employment statutes in which there are some statutes giving prevailing party fees. The courts don't like to do it if they can avoid it because it's a great burden on an individual and it has a chilling effect on a plaintiff's right to bring a lawsuit if they may have their whole net worth or their income put in jeopardy if on the chance that they lose.
Well, it seems to me that that's, Madam Chair, it seems to me that's precisely what we're trying to do here, is you want to call it a chilling effect. I guess I want to call it a sobering effect. I mean, I also have some experience with attorney fee statutes, and I also know how they work and when they get enforced and when they don't. And I also know what effect an attorney fee provision in a contract has on litigation. And it seems to me that if what you really want is people bringing only good faith litigation, then whether or not the ultimate attorney fee judgment is collectible, it seems to me that the fact that it exists is going to cause a plaintiff's attorney at least to discuss that item with his or her client, perhaps think twice or three times before filing the suit. But once all those hoops have been gone through, if that plaintiff is able to prove that someone knowingly misrepresented to the agency, let's get through all those hoops, then why should the statute of limitations not be extended?
We don't disagree that it should be extended if there is a true finding of intentional misrepresentation by the appropriate entity. Well, I have, I said at the beginning I had two reasons why I opposed it. The first was the forum, which is the jury instead of being the FDA or some other objective entity. The second reason is that we're not really imposing a fraud standard here. That is what it is represented to be, but the language is far from excluding misrepresentations other than fraud. For example, under a true fraud statute, what one has to prove is a misrepresentation that was knowingly made with intent to defraud, known to be material, and relied on by the other side. Those elements of common fraud are far different
Musgrave,
from
right.
what you have here. Pardon?
State of Oregon case was Musgrave.
Yes.
Right.
You know this well. The language here, you will note, does not address intent. It does not address that it is knowingly false, and it does not address a time period. Those are important factors because, as a practical matter, what happens in product liability litigation is that the product is judged with the benefit of hindsight. And there is Oregon law, thanks to Justice Lindy, who wrote a very convoluted opinion that Representative Clark is probably familiar with. It is difficult to know in Oregon whether you can, in fact, legally judge a product by today's standards in science, even though it was manufactured and represented to the FDA by standards of 10 or 15 years ago. That makes it a much more lenient standard to show misrepresentation under the statute than is actually required by fraud. It could very well be that information not given to the FDA at year one and considered to be totally irrelevant to any issue before the FDA could, through the imagination of a plaintiff's lawyer and the science available 10 years later, be judged to be relevant. And then this statute would come into play. So whether you consider that good or bad, it is a standard entirely different from fraud. The other part of this statute that is somewhat misleading is that it not only talks about misrepresentations to the FDA, but to physicians. The standard procedure in a plaintiff's products case is for a physician who has really become an advocate for the plaintiff to get on the stand and to say, if you'd shown me that document or given me this fact when I was prescribing this product, I wouldn't have used the product. Now, there are obviously physicians who are as much advocates on the defense side as on the plaintiff's side. For every doctor like Dr. Burry, who is a plaintiff's advocate, we can produce one who's a defendant's advocate. But what happens is it creates a fact question for the jury. I have seen treating physicians be handed documents such as an internal memo in a company that says, we could do this, but it would cost 50 cents to do it, and why bother, about a matter that has nothing whatever to do with the plaintiff's injury, but we're all human beings, and it incenses us, and we say, that's not a very good attitude for a drug company, and therefore, if I'd known that, I wouldn't have bought that product. That kind of evidence is not scientifically relevant, but it certainly can inflame a jury. And this standard would allow that kind of technique to create for the jury a question of whether a misrepresentation had made to the treating physician or inserting physician in this case, which would have been material to his decision. So it's a very misleading, it's a deceptive amendment on its face. It goes much beyond what it purports to when you come to applying it to a real life situation.
Madam Chair?
This particular IUD has been removed from the market.
Correct.
Is that right? Based upon what?
The inability of the insurance of the company to obtain insurance.
And the cost of litigation. The company watched the litigation expense for the cases that had been disposed of favorably to the company and realized that the enormous expense of defending that many lawsuits and disposing of them was more than they wanted to bear as a business matter.
What year was it removed?
1986. And remember, please remember, Madam Chair, that of over the more than 300 cases that were brought and have been settled in court, where there's been a court determination, all but four have been determined in the defendant's favor, the company's favor. There have been four the other way, and two of those are on appeal.
But I can tell you that clients complain about their legal fees, whether you win the case or you don't win the case. It's expensive to defend them.
Is the device being marketed in any other countries other than, I mean, or has it been withdrawn completely?
It continues to be marketed elsewhere. And in fact, for many months and years, I guess, even after it was off the market in the U.S., a lot of American women went to Canada to obtain them. And that's because the cost of insurance and the numbers of lawsuits are much smaller there and in other non-U.S. countries as well.
The World Health Organization, Madam Chair, continues to say that the copper IUD is the most effective birth control device available to women in the world today. And it's a tragedy that it's been removed from the market in Oregon. I mean, in the United States, excuse me, by this company, by the largest manufacturer of it.
Representative Mannix.
Thank you. Well, I'm trying to get back to some basic equities here, and correct me if I'm wrong. In terms of the Copper 7 IUD, that company's never gone bankrupt.
That is correct, ma'am.
Company's been in business?
Continues to be in business.
That the company discontinued the use of that type of IUD. That type of IUD has never been pulled off by the FDA. It's marketed internationally. So far, I'm correct.
Correct.
And the standard statute of limitations would apply in Oregon. And right now there's a proposal to amend this bill back to put the Copper 7 IUD back in, but right now you're clear, unless we amend the bill.
Madam Chair, Representative Mannix, I can write a script where there would still be women who could still bring cases today.
Well, then we'll move on to the Dalkon Shield. The A.H. Robbins Company went bankrupt. Judge Marriage in Richmond been taken over, has had the case for a long time. I recall seeing newspaper ads in Salem. I assume they were run all over the nation, calling upon women who had any claims against the A.H. Robbins Company in regard to the Dalkon Shield to do so. Was any Oregon statute of limitations applied to those claims? I'm seeing a nod back there. But
Mr. Williams and I have been debating this issue for years. I was representing A.H. Robbins at the time of the bankruptcy proceeding and authored a good share of the litigation in the bankruptcy court over what statute of limitations would apply, if any. I will point out that at the present time, the determination of whether there will be any statute of limitations applied is in the hands of the plaintiff because the trust has been created, which will be the fund of money to pay claims and to handle them, and that has been turned over to the plaintiffs. However, at the time it was still in front of Judge Marriage and the company had an interest in it, the company's position was that there should be a statute of limitations applied. The plaintiff's position was there should not be. The court's inclination was that if there were any statute applied, it would be that of the state of Maryland, which is the most liberal in the country. It is, in a short word, up to the plaintiffs as a group whether they want to impose any statute of limitations. There is no requirement that they do so. They have control of the trust and will be allowed, if they choose, to pay money to any claimant without regard to whether her claim is barred under any state statute.
May I follow up on this?
Yeah, Mannix.
During the time that those claims could be presented, did that occur, or did that overlap with this window of opportunity that occurred in Oregon once the Oregon legislature overturned the governor's veto?
There was no bar to women filing claims at the time the court went into bankruptcy, except under the traditional statute of limitations. If they'd had a claim that was barred 15 years ago, there might have been a
bar. What I'm getting at is there was a window of time created by the legislature to, in effect, set aside the statute of repose.
Yes.
And then bankruptcy proceedings created a special proceeding to file claims. Was there an overlap in those time frames?
There was an overlap, but I would like to point out that I don't think that the previous amendment had any bearing either. I think that the very most likely scenario is that there will not be a statute of limitations at all.
Well, even if we assume there was, though, there was an overlap.
Yes.
Now, what I'm coming around to then is if any woman had consulted with an attorney in regard to seeking redress, the attorney would have found it incumbent upon the attorney to have filed a claim on behalf of that woman or have done something in Oregon on behalf of that woman or else faced potential professional malpractice.
That's true. And now, I would, go ahead.
I assume that both of you are opposed to the bill generally, but then specifically are opposed to changes that move things around either with the Dalkon Shield or with the Copper 7.
I think neither of us is here taking a position with respect to the Dalkon Shield portion, even though I used to represent the company. I'm not here speaking on their behalf.
Right. I'm sorry, I shouldn't have just jumped
well,
into that.
Okay. Madam Chair, Representative Mannix, I would say my testimony that I didn't deliver does speak our concern about the idea of just continually moving the statute of repose and the statute of limitation, or eliminating the statute of repose and moving the statute of limitation, and for all the obvious reasons. Evidence gets dusty, people die, people's memories fail. There are good and sufficient reasons why these statutes are in our law books today, and I think there has to be a critical emergency on the horizon that mandates some kind of alteration of those statutes, and I would suggest that there is none, right, especially in the case of the coppers.
I should, as a last...
Representative Mannix.
As a last item, I should probably explain, in case any other witnesses are wondering where I'm coming from. What I'm looking at is whether or not someone had some reasonable opportunity to assert a claim in regard to a wrong and had some reasonable opportunity to know about it and to take action on it. If, for instance, the statute proposed, there may be some social policy reasons to overcome that. If there had been a proceeding which established that the Copper 7 or any other company had made misrepresentations in order to get certification from a federal agency for any kind of activity, then you may come back and say, well, the public at large, the legislature, everybody was misled. We want to go back. We want to clean this up, and we're going to undo some wrongdoing. I'd invite other people to keep that in mind. I'd like to hear about how there hasn't been some opportunity to present a claim for relief at some point within reason. Thank you.
That window is still open, Representative Mannix, and does till July 1 of this year.
I would like, Madam Chair, may I point out in response to that last comment that with respect to the Dalkon Shield, the window of opportunity for filing a claim within the bankruptcy court was far broader than it is generally to proceed in court, because there was a $4.5 million advertising campaign which stated that anyone who believed they may have used a device, whether they knew the type or not, should file a claim. And it did receive approximately 300,000 responses. So the news did get out. And there was no bar to people filing a claim in the bankruptcy court for the shield, whether they had a counsel advising them or not.
Thank you.
Representative Calhoun.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I understand you correctly, there were 320 cases brought. There are four plaintiff's verdicts. Does that mean you're saying that there were 316 defense verdicts?
Madam Chair, Representative Calhoun, or dismissals, or summary judgments, or the court threw it out, or whatever.
Or settlement?
No. Madam Chair, Representative Calhoun, does not include settlements, cases that were settled. These are cases that came to final judicial determination of some type or another by a judge.
Representative Calhoun.
Do you have some kind of statistic on how many cases were settled?
I don't have, to my knowledge, Representative Calhoun. I'd be glad to ask a gentleman from Searle who is here if he knows, or I can get that information and get it to you later. It's your choice. It's your pleasure.
Clark and I are having a call of the answer to the question.
I think it's a great question.
I think we need to know that.
Okay. The question is asked. There's nothing that I can do to... the question is asked.
Madam
okay.
Chair.
Sorry. Representative Mannix.
I'd be interested in the breakdown between nuisance value settlements and settlements based on the merits.
Yeah. Madam Chair, that's my point also.
President.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Stuart Charney. I'm an attorney with G.D. Searle and manager of policy planning. With respect to your question, Searle does keep figures with respect to settlements. Needless to say, settlements do not indicate how the case would have gone. I do not know if Searle has a breakdown of what is a nuisance value as opposed to a true settlement. I don't know if we can discern between the two sometimes. I will endeavor to get any information we can on the settlement. I don't have a true figure for you. I think, just so you know, what is a nuisance value? I'm not certain. If you could just...
For the record, in case, Madam
Representative Mannix.
In case anyone's wondering what nuisance value means,
Thank
it doesn't mean that the person is a nuisance. It means the cost of having to defend the case, bring in expert witnesses, put together your evidence, go to trial. although some people may, it's not meant to be a pejorative. Thank you.
Thank you for clearing that up, Representative Mannix. Representative Mannix?
I guess the question I had, do you have an idea what the average settlement cost was? Cost of the settlement versus cost of defending the...
I would wonder if there is an average settlement cost. It's a good term because before a settlement comes into play, there's a whole part of discovery you have to go through. I think in many cases, the discovery, perhaps Ms. Hewitt could help out, costs more than the settlement. So our expenses are much greater before we actually entertain the thought of a settlement.
Madam Chair.
Representative Clark.
Aside from any potential judgment, what would a case like this cost you to take to trial and defend?
Madam Chair, Representative Clark, I am not confident that I could answer that question. There are many variables that go into it.
I could answer the question not on behalf of Searle, but as a defense lawyer in products liability cases. It's not at all unusual for the defense of a case to cost $1 million.
I'm sorry.
Representative Mason.
Now you really got us off into another area. Why $1 million?
Because you are talking about perhaps 10 expert witnesses. If you have a drug or a device, you have expert witnesses in epidemiology, in microbiology, in biochemistry.
And finally, it provided the State Court Administrator's Office with the authority to enter into contracts for appellate indigent defense work. The Dash 2 amendments that are in front of you today add some significant fiscally related issues to the bill. First of all, these amendments fold into Senate Bill 284, the partial contribution system, whereby defendants at the beginning of their criminal proceeding would be asked to contribute to the cost of their defense. You saw this issue earlier in House Bill 2264, which, as I understand it, still is in this subcommittee. We expect, under the partial contribution scheme, to collect somewhere between $2 and $3 million from indigent defendants in the coming biennial period. Another provision of the Dash 2 amendments that relates to partial contribution is language that you'll see on page 2, lines 4 and 5 of the bill that tighten up the definition of indigency, providing that in the current statutory definition where we talk about hardship in providing necessities to the defendant or the defendant's family, we add in the words basic economic necessities and the defendant's dependent family. The Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 284 would also eliminate post-conviction as a remedy for defendants who have been convicted. However, I understand that because of some concerns that both the defense bar and the prosecution bar had with post-conviction, that there will be a suggestion made to simply limit the time in which a post-conviction petition can be filed to 120 days, which is identical to House Bill 2796, which came out of this committee and passed the House but has not been heard in the Senate.
I'd just like to add to that, Mr. Linden, that the source of that discussion was some comments that, although it had been discussed before, I think it was crystallized by Representative Minnis, who had suggested that indigent defense counsel rights be removed from post-conviction relief cases.
I think it was Representative Baum, actually.
Was it Representative Baum? I'm sorry. That's right, it was. I get you mixed up.
I thought it was Minnis and Mannix, Madam Chair.
That too, Representative Mannix.
The,
go ahead, Mr.
The fiscal effect of limiting post-conviction petitions to 120 days is, we can't really determine it, but it definitely would save some money. If the total remedy were released, it would save some $600,000.
What did you just say? You can't figure out how much
elimination of post-conviction relief?
No, if we were to eliminate post-conviction relief as a remedy, we know that we would save $600,000 in the Indigent Defense Fund, and the state public defender would save some undetermined amount of money, because I haven't seen a fiscal impact from them. However, if you limit post-conviction petitions to being filed within 120 days, we don't have any kind of system to track 120-day periods at this point in time, but we would certainly put one into place so that we could measure the impact. But it would be something less than $600,000. Most post-conviction petitions will be filed within 120 days. What the 120-day limitation gets you is that it takes away the opportunity for defendants with perhaps a little bit of time on their hand to file post-conviction petitions at periods of time that are quite extended from when they were actually convicted. On page 11 of the Dash 2 amendments, there is language that would, 11 and 12, there is language that would require...
Ms. Madam Chair, before we go on...
Yes, Representative Baum.
Where in the bill does it do away with post-conviction, or try to?
Madam Chair, Representative Baum, Section 22 on page 11 repeals all of the different post-conviction relief statutes that are presently in place. So if you wanted to go with the 120-day language that's going to be suggested to you, you'd want to make sure you don't repeal those, and you'd want to conform those sections to the provisions of House Bill 2796, which imposed the 120-day period. Or you'd want to take the provisions of House Bill 2796 and move them into Senate Bill 284.
Can I have another question?
Representative Baum.
What would happen if we went ahead and not only did a 120-day limitation, but also did away with the right to court-appointed counsel?
Madam Chair, Representative Baum, you would have a positive fiscal impact, and you would probably have a negative operational impact, because if they still have the right to file post-conviction petitions but are not afforded the right to counsel, the courts and I think the AG's office would tell you that the process then of handling those petitions is going to be much more protracted and time-consuming than it currently is when you have the state public defender serving as counsel for, in most cases, for the petitioners. We know that in every type of case that we have, if you have a pro se party, the time it takes to resolve those matters is generally going to be more extended than if you have experienced counsel handling and representing one of the parties.
Has there been any fiscal, any idea of how many more attorney generals you'd have to employ, or has there been any analysis done on what would happen if you took away the right to counsel on post-conviction relief?
Madam Chair, Representative Baum, I have not seen any estimate from the Attorney General's office.
If they have to add two people on, let's say, that would be still a lot less than $500,000.
Madam Chair, Representative Baum, you're correct. In Marion County, where most of the post-conviction petitions are handled, we have a judge currently, Judge Barber, who I think has testified on this issue before, handles the great majority of post-conviction petitions. We would have to put a second judge on that assignment if the time spent on processing these petitions were to increase at all. Now, it doesn't mean a second judge full-time, but we'd have to give Judge Barber some help. Now, that's an indirect cost increase because we're already paying a judge's salary and we're already paying for his or her staff, but it would be more work for the court to handle.
What makes you think that if we do away with post-conviction relief, we won't just have it all filed under habeas corpus?
Madam Chair, Representative Baum, we would have a lot of the same issues filed under habeas corpus or one of the other common law writs. There was a writ of coram nobis that used to be in somewhat widespread use until the post-conviction statutes were first initiated in the late 50s. So we could see, if post-conviction were eliminated, we could see a lot of those same issues coming up on habeas. So that's why the 120-day language, which again, I believe both defense and prosecution are interested in, would be a reasonable mid-ground.
Maybe you just went through this and I missed it. Right to counsel in habeas corpus proceedings?
Madam Chair, Representative Clark, yes, there is a right to counsel.
Court-appointed, I mean.
Correct.
Okay.
Representative Mannix.
Are some of the provisions here similar to the ones that were in the House bill regarding setting up the or the requirement of the economic necessity, substantial hardship, and so on?
Madam Chair, Representative Mannix, the economic necessity language is identical to what was in the 2264, and the partial contribution system is, I believe, identical to what was in that particular bill.
What I'm getting at in a friendly way, then, is I don't have to read sections 12 to 15 of this act again to make sure that they're okay.
That's correct.
You're just taking from that bill.
That's correct.
Thanks.
Other questions? Go ahead, Bill.
Okay. A third major issue in the bill you'll find on pages 11 and 12 of the Dash 2 amendments. It would basically require that the district attorneys seek violation treatment for all nonviolent first offense misdemeanors unless the district attorney can provide to the court some compelling reasons for not seeking such treatment. Now, the fiscal impact of doing this would be, there could be a multi-million dollar impact, but it depends on how it's implemented. There'd be two choices. You could either decide at the front end not to even charge a misdemeanor and instead bring the person in on a violation, or you could charge as a misdemeanor, at which point the right to counsel attaches, but dispose of it as a violation, which at least in theory should cut down on the attorney hours that would be involved in disposing of the case. It would depend on how the individual district attorneys decided to implement this section, if in fact it is enacted into law. But in either case, there will be savings to the system, and there will be a relatively easy way of tracking as we go what those savings are, because we have a system right now for segregating out misdemeanors versus felonies, and we can watch what's happening to those misdemeanors that are treated as violations.
Madam Chair.
Representative Dennis.
Question's been on my mind since we started talking about the Dash 2 amendments is, whose are they, where were they conceived from, and why this committee didn't have an opportunity to view them prior to today's meeting? I guess it's a question for the chair and for council.
Well, I guess I can answer that. First, Representative Minnis, the post-conviction relief, there was a bill that,
I'm familiar
through,
with post-
which was Representative Baum's bill. Right. That had a 120-day limit.
I'm familiar.
I don't know
with that.
If you recall, you did mention one day when we were talking about another bill, and I don't remember which bill, that you would prefer looking at the issue from a position of not allowing counsel in post-conviction relief cases.
I'm familiar with the post-conviction relief issue. I guess I'm looking at page 12 and some fairly startling and far-reaching amendments. And I'm wondering whose they are and why we didn't have an opportunity to discuss them.
Well, I'm trying to answer your question, Representative Minnis, as a package. You only want to talk about some of the Dash 2 amendment. I would suggest that there has been a group of people who worked all during the session trying to figure out something to do about the high cost of indigent defense. And then there were suggestions that were made by committee members which were favorably received. I think all of them have been discussed. The issue that is that you're raising, which is section 23 on page 11, has also been discussed, and it in fact codifies the method that's being used by DAs, I think, currently in Marion County and in Multnomah County to deal with first-time misdemeanants. That's all. And the only reason you haven't seen it before is that we didn't think of it before. I mean, there's nothing sinister about the bill appearing in front of you in this forum today. At least I don't believe there is.
So, Madam Chair, if I'm hearing your comments correctly, this is a compilation of issues that at various times have been discussed by this committee and in some working group somewhere. And this is a compilation of those issues.
I think all by this
that are in
committee.
Agreement.
That's correct, Representative Minnis.
Madam Chair.
Representative Mannix.
What about the proposal that Representative Baum had been talking about before, which was we leave post-conviction relief, but we limit it to 120 days. And then in terms of the provision of counsel, there's a problem that we would have to provide counsel or not have to provide counsel. Could we just say we're not going to provide counsel for post-conviction relief?
Madam Chair, Representative Mannix, if you decide to limit it to 120 days, it'd be my recommendation that you not eliminate the right to counsel.
What if we limited it to 60 days, but not eliminate the right to counsel? Some of us had talked about that time frame before.
Madam Chair, Representative Mannix, I'm not certain what reasons were presented. I don't recall what reasons were presented before why 60 days wouldn't work. I think it was just too little a time frame, but I guess, you know, we're willing to work within whatever time frame the committee decides is best.
Aren't the vast majority of the stronger post-conviction relief petitions filed within 60 days anyway? I shouldn't ask that question because there's no real time frame problem right now, so it's hard to tell.
Madam Chair, Representative Mannix, that's why it's hard for me to respond. We just don't know. I know there's a perception that if you limit it to 120 days, you're going to catch most of the tough ones within that, most of the meritorious ones within that time period.
Follow-up question?
Yes, Representative Mannix.
Is your recommendation against not taking attorneys out on post-conviction relief fiscal or convenience for the courts? And, I mean, I can imagine a lot of pro se petitions there.
Madam Chair, Representative Mannix, I think it's going to cost the system more time or as much time as it would if we have experienced lawyers who've handled many, many thousands of post-conviction cases involved.
Are you encouraging us to do away with the post-conviction relief? I wasn't focusing on that earlier, and then I picked up on that's what's in here.
Madam Chair, Representative Mannix, no, not specifically. As a matter of fact, I am more comfortable with the 120-day limitation.
Thank you.
If the right to post-conviction relief were eliminated, obviously the Supreme Court would have to resolve it at some point, and we don't get comfortable.
We'd have more habeas corpus petitions.
That's correct. Madam Chair,
Go ahead.
The last major issue presented in the Dash 2 amendments is on page 12, lines 21 through 24, that would require that measures of this body that have a fiscal impact on the Indigent Defense Fund shall include an appropriations section. The reasoning behind this is that it doesn't mean, in my opinion, at least as I read it, that there'd be a prohibition on passing measures that have an increase. There would simply have to be an acknowledgement of the fiscal implication. It's immaterial to the Judicial Department whether we're the body to make the estimate of what the impact is, or if it's going to be legislative fiscal or executive budget or whoever. So if there's any concerns along those lines, we're not wedded to being the source of the information that would determine whether or not there's a fiscal impact. In addition to the Dash 2 amendments, we have proposed some additional amendments which were just passed out today. They're dated June 12th, offered as Judicial Department amendments to Senate Bill 284. What these would do would be to create a other funds account in the Judicial Department where the proceeds from the partial payment by indigent defendants, part of the Dash 2 amendments, where proceeds would go in order to support, without creating a new drain on general fund resources, an indigency verification program in every county in the state. We presently have four pilot counties where we've had people dedicated to the function of dedicated in the sense of it's all they do, verifying financial statements submitted by defendants who have requested court-appointed counsel. And in those four counties, we have found that 16% of the people requesting counsel have been turned down on the basis of the additional verification work that's been done by the verification staff. We believe that if we were to be able to expand that program to all 36 counties, that we would see similarly dramatic reductions in the number of defendants who we'd have to appoint counsel for. It's my assessment that our budget request asking for general funds to set up the indigency verification programs will not be approved. And I think there's a certain symmetry to having the proceeds that we receive from criminal defendants that are supposed to go towards the cost of their defense dedicated to the indigency verification effort, which will be designed to limit the number of defendants we have to provide counsel for. And I would strongly recommend consideration of this other funds revolving account where we could, I believe, not only pay for the cost of the verification, but have funds left in that account to be used for other indigent defense purposes, most notably if we run into deficit situations during the course of any biennium. The new amendments we were offering would also dedicate into that fund the recoupment monies that we presently receive from defendants at the conclusion of a case. And in this biennium, we expect to collect just under $3 million. Those funds would also be available for indigent defense purposes, although the way the bill's written, at the end of a biennium, if there were any balance in the account beyond what was needed to operate the verification program, those revenues would revert to the general fund. So those are the major features of Senate Bill 284 as it came to you from the Senate, with and of the Dash 2 amendments and then the June 12th amendments that we're presenting.
Let me just comment that the reason the committee has asked Representative Gilmore to be here, and I'm delighted that you're here, and I think the record, I guess the record does reflect that since we're video recorded, is to take a look at this process up against what is going on in terms of budget and trying to budget for indigent defense, which is a disaster in the state budget. And to, and also, and Representative Minnison, I apologize for being, I suppose, sort of snappy about it, but also to try to fold together some of the proposals that have floated around the building during the course of the session, which pertain to cost savings within that system, and achieve some cost savings. Representative Minnis.
Madam Chair, I appreciate that. The only thing is we've looked at, and we haven't really looked comprehensively at indigent defense in this committee, and it's a concern of mine. And one of the issues that's never been addressed is why it costs 2 and 3 times as much in Multnomah County for the exact same kind of felony charge as it does in Marion County. And we keep looking at ways to try to lower the impact on the fund by steering away from this right to counsel issue and going around it by moving things into a violation category, as opposed to looking at better ways to administrate the program so that the costs per case are similar in experience statewide.
Does it cost twice as much in Multnomah County, Mr. Linden? Let me just follow up, because I mean there are two or three questions in Representative Minnis's question, and I'm interested.
Madam Chair, it does not cost twice as much. But if you look at individual cases, it might. Across the board, it doesn't. We do know the cost of the legal system in Multnomah County is the highest in the state, and there's a variety of reasons for that. The system's very complex up there. It doesn't run as efficiently as some systems in other counties. But the main reason in Marion County why the costs appear to be across the board somewhat lower is that for years, attorneys in this community have voluntarily, inexplicably, and consistently provided indigent defense services at a cost that results in them heavily subsidizing the system. We go with the best deal we can get, and in Marion County, the best deal we can get is the private bar-appointed system that we have right now in place. I think if there were ever a public defender office created by the bar here in this county, or if they banded together in a consortium, we would see the costs of services in this county rise. Because there's no question, in Marion County, the amount of money that we pay for indigent defense is less than in other counties with similar size caseloads.
Is that discrepancy linked to the fact that we do provide indigent defense counsel by statute to some defendants who would not strictly under the Constitution be eligible for indigent defense representation?
Well, Madam Chair, As one of the documents we've given to the committee earlier outlined the Spangenberg report, Oregon has one of the highest standards of or thresholds of right to counsel in the country. we appoint counsel in many different types of proceedings by statute or constitutional decision, and we have right to counsel provisions in the state that are much more stringent than in other states and that even exceed what the federal guarantees are.
When you say stringent, you mean more liberal, actually.
More liberal. It depends on, yes, that you're correct. More liberal than in other states in the country. However, I think most people that have spent time in this area will agree that the only way to deal with that would be through constitutional amendment, because we have case law in the state that that in some ways reinforces that liberal threshold. And the most important case is probably the Brown versus Multnomah County decision in the late 70s. But even statutorily, we have many more rights to counsel that are provided than are provided in other states.
Representative Calhoun.
I'm sure asking one of the reasons for the discrepancies. I've worked in three different counties in the criminal justice system, and I think we had people from both sides of the bar in Lane County. The amount of litigation in any case in Lane County is incredible compared to Douglas or Jackson County. So one of the things that I know that the discrepancies in costs relate to is just how much or what the procedure is in various counties. For instance, in Jackson County, you just get on the phone, call up, you work things out, and you never file a piece of paper. In Lane County, the first thing you might do is file as much paper as you can, create a paper trail, as it's known, because that's the way you work out the best deal for your client. So there are a lot of things like that. I'd say Lane County has a lot more funding for their DA's office than does Jackson County per capita and for the caseload, and that might be one of the reasons for the additional litigation. So when you give a lot to one side, it creates additional cost to the other side.
I guess let me make a comment right here, because I'd like to satisfy Representative Minnis's concern that we haven't had the ultimate hearing on indigent defense in this committee. I think we've had several hearings, and we've got six bills following this bill tonight, and selfish, I suppose, but my daughter's graduating from school tonight, and I'm going to be there.
Good. Let's move on this stuff.
So if we could move, I'd like to do that.
Madam Chair?
Are there questions for Mr. Linden?
On this June 12 set of amendments, not the dash 2, you had some comments about some changes?
Madam Chair, Representative Mannix, those June 12th amendments would set up the account by which we would pay recoupment and partial
I heard all that. I thought I'd heard something about adding some other language here or changing. As it is, it's all right with you?
It's fine, although I would note on the second page of them, misdemeanors. Well, actually, the second page amendments at the bottom would provide that the misdemeanor to violation treatment would not apply to the misdemeanors of DUII or attempting to elude. And that was, a general agreement of some of the people that were involved in discussions on this, that those should be defined out.
All right.
This is page 12, section 23, lines 2 through 6.
So that's another major policy issue that's included in the June 12th amendments.
Thank you. Other
Madam
questions?
Chair?
Representative Mannix.
Are we in work session?
Not yet. We've got two more witnesses, okay. Three more witnesses. Thank you, Mr.
Thank
Linden.
You.
Doug Harkelrode. Learning.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Doug Harkelrode. I'm the president of the District Attorneys Association this year and Lane County's district attorney. We support the majority of the proposed amendments to the Senate Bill, A. and Gross Senate Bill 284. Those sections 12 through 15 mentioned earlier, those are fine with us. Indigency verification is an excellent idea. I have, through the courtesy of your bailiff or clerk there, passed out some amendments. I would like briefly to mention the first one there that's on page 11, lines 7, 8, and 9. That's the post-conviction relief information that you've just heard about. We think it's better policy to have a 120-day limit rather than to eliminate post-conviction relief. I think we'll see most of those in habeas corpus or some other way. So a time limit on currently something with no time limit would be our suggestion.
May I ask a quick question on that? What happened to our 120-day bill?
I don't know the answer to that.
Cohen's committee.
I think it's kind of dead right now.
I guess we better be inserting it into something.
I think
Thank
inserting
you.
It would be
probably wise. They're backed up over in the other side.
Well, make it easier for them.
Backed up? Was that the phrase?
Their dockets have been long.
Yeah, backed up. That's interesting.
Our next.
I'm very charitable of you, Mr. Arnold.
Actually, Representative Clark, I would say that that was the situation we're in this committee right now. I'm sure that report is going back.
Moving along quickly, Madam Chair. On page 12, lines 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6, that's the section which would make first offense misdemeanors of a nonviolent character violations unless there were compelling reasons for district attorneys to file those or litigate them as crimes and thereby have court-appointed attorney costs. This is a balancing question, I'd suggest to the members of the committee, to balance your indigent defense costs over here, which I understand are very high, with what you're going to do to the statutes in the state of Oregon. And so when I review those misdemeanors, what this will do is, except in compelling cases, whatever that word compelling means, and we, I'm sure, litigate that out, hopefully maybe establish some legislative history, but whatever that means, your standard shoplifting case on a first offense basis would no longer be a crime in the state of Oregon. False swearing on an application for court-appointed attorney. Recall, we just did sections 12 through 15 or talked about those where you would apply under oath for a court-appointed attorney. If you lie under that, under this section, you would now find that it would be a maximum penalty of a $250 fine for lying to get your court-appointed attorney.
Can we send those people to jail now, Mr. Harkelrod?
Sometimes, sometimes not.
It speaks differently to the jail space situation than I've heard during the last 6 months.
There are a wide range of sentencing alternatives when a person is convicted of a crime. There's probation to the court. There's probation, formal probation. There's work release type programs. There are counseling type programs. All of those things are available on a misdemeanor sentence that are not available on a violation sentence. So there's a wide range of alternatives, and the judge has choices to make that he can or she can make.
Giving the judge that range of alternatives, which generally I think we could agree would not include jail, is worth the additional cost to the state of an indigent defense attorney for a first offense. That's
yes.
Your position.
Yeah, if I might continue with some additional crimes here that this would affect. Escape in the third degree, where people run.